Now, where in this time frame was St. Stephen's established?
St. Stephen's was established in 1962. So we got started pretty early.
Yeah.
I spent from 59 to 62 as the intern at Bishop J. Blake's church, and he was over at 38th and Ocean View. Bishop Charles Blake, the current presiding bishop, was in college and seminary when I came here.
Okay.
And I stayed there with Bishop Blake until I got started at St. Stephen's in 1959 to 62.
Okay. Why did you feel the need, or there was a call to start your own?
Yeah, I came here to find my place of ministry and service. I knew that when I came, I would spend time learning the area, receiving being mentored by a master churchman, and getting acquainted with what is required in ministry. So I spent 2 years there, and I knew all the time. And when the time came, I discussed it with him, with Bishop J. Blake, that I was about ready to go out and to begin my life's work. He said, "Fine, you've been faithful here, you've been dependable," and I saw him do something that I'd never seen done before. On a Sunday morning, he announced to the people that I was leaving and said, "George McKinney has been very helpful in this ministry, and he's going out to plant a church. If any of the members here would like to go and help him, you're free to do so."
Oh, wow. That is unheard of. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is really amazing. How many people did you start with?
About 10.
And now how many are there? And I know it's
about... Yeah. Well, there are about 20... churches have been established
under
and then there some of them have as many as 5,000 members and some as little as 50.
So were these church plants?
Some of them were, and some were persons received their training and then went to seminary. We encourage them to go to seminary, and many of them have just continued the work of the Lord. A lot of the churches here trace that history to St. Stephen's.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
What are some of the major accomplishments that under St. Stephen's leadership and headship that you would like to highlight? I know you've done many, many, many things in the community.
Let me just mention that we have been attempting to fulfill a vision that indicated that there are a lot of people in the urban community and in the city generally who are experiencing emptiness, loneliness, frustration, meaninglessness, and all of that. And so the church must have a clear message of a proclamation of the kingdom of God. That's what we've tried to proclaim, that the rule of God is now. Not pie in the sky, but right now God wants us to experience kingdom living. So that's a proclamation, and then that's the preaching. Secondly, we've attempted to maintain consistent teaching to equip people for living abundantly. I think people will do better when they know better.
Mm-hmm. We should hope so.
Huh?
I say yes, one should hope so.
Yes. So the teaching involved from the child, from the cradle to the grave, we are just constantly trying to teach mm-hmm. what it means to live, teaching management, how to treat labor, and wives and husbands, parents and children, neighbors. We're teaching the values that really separate us from the beast.
Okay.
We're teaching health issues and the importance of marriage
right.
and fidelity. And we believe that in the kingdom there is the reality, the very real possibility of experiencing substantial healing.
Mm-hmm.
Although we all going to die with something, because the death rate is 1 out of 1.
Right.
But while we're here, we can experience healing. We believe that the doctor is an agent of God, because if any healing takes place, we believe God is responsible for it, whether it's through the Western traditional medicine or alternative medicine
mm-hmm.
or acupuncture or whatever means is used.
Mm-hmm.
So we focused upon preaching, teaching, and healing.
Okay.
Now, in terms of practical accomplishments, we believe that the activities that have made the greatest impact have been when we have organized institutions and staffed it with committed, passionate people competent to implement. For example, we were the first church in the community to sponsor a halfway house for delinquent boys.
Mm.
It operated for 10 years. And I was probation officer, but I also was the house father. And we maintained, we had several hundred teenage boys who were placed there by the courts,
mm-hmm.
by youth department for rehabilitation. We operated from 64 to 74, but when the wave of violence hit the community, and it was difficult to deal. I personally couldn't deal with that when one of the young men shot and killed another one in the house, and you agonize behind that.
Right.
And so after that, we closed it.
Okay.
Couldn't prevent it, but I still see young men who were placed with me in 62, 63.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I've got not a young man now, one of the first residents of that group home contacted me about 4 or 5 months ago by letter and said, I'm Arthur Rankin, and I'm in prison. I'm being released from prison. He's 62 years old.
Oh.
And he wanted to know, can you help me now?
Mm.
He stayed in my house for about a year, 18 months, back in the 60s, and now he's 62. He looks like an old man, looks older than I am.
He's had a rough life.
A rough life, but I remember him. He'd been in 15 foster homes.
Mm.
Didn't know his father. His mother was mentally ill.
So he just didn't have that foundation.
He didn't have it.
And that is so important. Wow.
But he remembered me, and now, you know what? We said, come on, we'll help you, son. We've got a house, transition house.
Mm-hmm.
And for about 3 months now, he's been a resident there. He's going to church.
Wonderful.
Bought him some clothes.
That is great.
Yeah.
Wow. And hopefully, prayerfully, this is that turning point he needs.
Maybe can do it now.
Yeah.
Also, we feel that it was impactful to sponsor the Christian school K through 12.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of course, the child care center, but that's a different, that's another story. But the Christian school, I think how that really evolved. In the 60s, we were involved in a lawsuit here in San Diego, the Carlin case, you may have heard
right.
of it.
Right, yes, we have the papers from the Carlin case in the library.
Mm-hmm. Well, during that season, the attitude at the Board of Education and with the superintendent was that there should be no effort to provide quality education to the black kids because we were really inferior and limited. So a group of us met with then superintendent because we were concerned about the rapid turnover of the teachers at the schools in our neighborhood, because the teachers come in and as soon as they get a foothold, they mm-hmm. can move to a better
right.
look better location with less troublesome students. Mm-hmm. They were doing so. The rapid turnover in the classroom, a student may have 6 or 8 different teachers in the course of a year, and that was not good.
Oh, no.
And there was also problems regarding the quality of the counseling. I remember there was a young lady at one of the high schools that was predominantly black at that time. She was second in the graduating class, and her counselor, a white counselor, said that you'll be wasting your time to go to college. You should just get you a job. And so they weren't. She happened to be at St. Stephen's, and he told me what had happened. And I assisted her in getting an application in to get a scholarship to UCSD. Mm-hmm. And they accepted her. It was not that she couldn't go to college. That was the mentality of the counselor.
And it's so sad that those same things are happening now to our kids.
You think they're still happening?
I do. I still think there are people who are telling students who can do that they can't do.
Yeah.
Or minimizing the level of where they could go next in life.
And that should not be the counselor's role.
No.
You're supposed to be enabling,
That's
inspiring,
right. That's right.
lifting up. And so when the principal responded to us, and he didn't probably understand how gross it was what he was saying. But he said that how can we reward our excellent teachers whom we discover down there except promote them and transfer them to a better neighborhood? We don't want our best teachers to be stuck down there. That was insulting to me. It made me angry.
Right.
So I said,
our students don't deserve the best.
That was what he was saying.
Yeah.
I understood that. So we got a committee together down at the church, and we organized an educational foundation and rented some portable classrooms and started a school. I went around the country and recruited teachers, educational missionaries. I got them here from Harvard, Yale, mm-hmm. Stanford. Some came from San Diego State, mm-hmm. Santa Barbara. And it was a small school, about 250 students, but K-12.
Right.
And we had people there who wanted to work. And we did a fantastic job.
Wow.
That had impact. Still, I was at the University of UCSD yesterday and honoring Jackie Edwards, who's retiring as the director of benefits for the university. And she and her husband had 3 sons. They were students at St. Stephen's,
mm-hmm.
and they are all now college graduates, MBAs. And
is so wonderful.
But they get their training at St. Stephen's. And this is very pleasing. Our graduates have done well.
Do you track them?
They got a Facebook page or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to begin to do a better job of tracking them.
That would be nice to just see,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, visual for people who come into the church to see this is our product. This, you know, they had their beginning at St. Stephen's. See how, you know. I think students take a lot from that sort of thing. To, oh, if they did this, they started here, I mm-hmm. can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Even have a peer mentoring yeah. or, you know, so that would be good.
Yeah, I think that's I made a note here.
Okay.
<All right.
coughs> Now, I know this is...
Can I mention the other institutions?
Oh, yes, yes.
From 1964 to 74, we had the St. Stephen's Group Home, which was a halfway house.
Okay.
We operated the daycare center, and it was a tremendous service to the community. But there were very few licensed child care centers in mm-hmm. in Southeast San Diego. There was only one at the time we started.
Well, what year was that?
That was in 1963.
Okay.
And then, of course, we had the counseling center that's been operating since the late 70s. Is that...
You're fine.
It's okay still? Mm-hmm. Didn't cut this off, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Talk up. You get really, really low.
Oh, okay. She said picks up pretty good. Is it picking up still?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. It has a bar, so you're doing okay.
Okay. Then we mentioned the retirement. Oh, back in the 50s, back in the 80s too, we started a federally chartered credit union.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Sunrise.
Now that's really unusual.
Yeah.
A lot of churches try.
Yeah, we got the charter.
Okay.
And we also, I mentioned the counseling center.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been able to have psychiatrists, psychologists, and pastoral counselors providing crisis intervention. Mentoring, tutoring, and all the rest of that.
Mm-hmm.
In 79, we organized the St. Stephen's Retirement Center, Inc., and began planning for building facilities to house seniors.
Okay.
And we got our first HUD grant of $3.5 million in 1987 or 1988 to build the retirement center, that 60 units.
You remember I visited there. They are so nice.
I took you there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Beautiful.
And then, of course, in 2005, we built the second facility, the Gene McKinney Manor.
Okay.
And I want to mention to you again that the architect for the $7 million facility went to nursery school at St. Stephen's.
What?
Yeah.
Now you're talking about coming full circle.
That's amazing. Nursery school.
Nursery school.
Yeah, yeah. A black architect.
Female?
Yes, right. Yes, yes.
Oh, wow.
We stress.
That chills through me. That is wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Huh. So what's next on the horizon?
I don't know if you heard the news that we have been attempting to acquire 4.5 acres of land across the street from the church.
Okay.
For about 12, 14 years. And we had met with great opposition from city and some community mm-hmm. resources. But there was a concern that that whoever developed that land should make sure that the city would benefit from a stream of tax revenue.
Okay.
And we felt that we would be able to meet that requirement, but the powers that be didn't think that we could.
So they wanted to ensure that there were businesses and things of that sort on
that's
the property.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And I understand that. But it seemed that it would be appropriate for us, since we've been in the community for 50 years, to have the opportunity to demonstrate what we could do. Mm-hmm. After having several failed attempts, releasing, giving contracts to different entities, and the latest one was in 2008 to a company out of Beverly Hills, Pacific Developers.
Yes, Sergeant Rank, I read that. Something about that.
Well, and it was discovered that there was corruption, and so we put pressure, and they had to reopen the bid process, not an RFP again, and we submitted again. This was about the third or fourth time that we've tried. But this time, we were awarded the right to enter into exclusive negotiations for the contract. And so that starts like right away.
So the land is your land?
It will be our land as soon as we get through these negotiations.
Okay.
We have a business partner, a financial partner that has come to stand along with us, mm-hmm. whose records have been examined by the city, and it is verified that this partner has the capability of delivering. Okay. He's promised to bring $30 million to the table to enable us to build retail, community space, comprehensive health clinic, drugstore, fresh and easy grocery store, restaurant.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. All that's so needed in that area.
Library, mm-hmm. Mediation center, so that we can revitalize that old counseling center, make it also a mediation center. My wife is a certified mediator.
Oh, okay.
She served as a judge in Texas as well.
Wonderful. I'll help you with the library.
Will you really?
Yes, put it down. It's on here.
And we've got one witness here. My
wife
witnesses.
Absolutely. Oh, that is so wonderful.
So that's where that would keep us busy for the next 5 years.
Oh.
And in the meantime, we are seeing.
What are you looking at as a date to? Within, what is this, 2010? So maybe like 2015?
Oh, actually, between two and two and a half years, we should be able to finish it.
Oh, okay.
That problem with permits and zoning and all of that. But I think if we can move quickly in 2.5 years, two and a half, 3 years, we should be able to see a big change there. I think it was also an important thing that in 1970, after having been involved in ministry for a number of years, I thought it was wise to go back to school and do a doctorate degree and have a kind of a mid-course evaluation. And so I did enroll at the California Graduate School of Theology for the PhD and was able to complete that work in 2 years.
Oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm. In 1985.
So it's an earned PhD.
Yes, it's a PhD. But my focus was the study of the church, ecclesiology.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I have some honorary degrees as well from, you may know, Geneva College back in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. I have a doctorate from them and from a couple of other schools. In 1985, was selected to serve as the bishop for the San Diego Diocese. Prior to being made bishop, I'd served for a number of years on the board for our seminary. Mm-hmm. In Atlanta. It's the Mason Seminary, and it is a part of the Interdenominational Theological Center of Atlanta.
Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I had seen women who came to the seminary, took the same course that men take, graduated with the same degrees, same passion and commitment to serve the Lord, but because of the culture and the history of our church, they had not been allowed to be ordained as pastors.
Mm.
There would be an occasional ordination, special ordination, allowing the woman to serve as a chaplain in a hospital or in the military, but not to go back to her home and pastor a church where she may have passion.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that was unjust. I felt that was not right. I know that the history has been that it's been a man's world.
Yes.
So when I became a bishop and had the authority to ordain, I became a bishop in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
In 1989, I ordained 12 women. And all hell broke loose.
Oh. So how did you handle it?
It was very difficult because the what I knew to be was revealed.
That were you ostracized within your...
Oh, yeah. And I was told that my future was over in the church. But that didn't happen. I'm a member of the general board now. I'm a part of the 12. At the last election, there were...
I see you several times on TV at different.
Yeah,
I know him.
Yeah. No, it didn't. It was a very traumatic experience for me, though, because people whom I love and work with and respect somehow had been infected by this false notion that God is selective in whom He calls on the basis of agenda.
Right.
And, of course, I argued then that I had to appear before a special committee that I had violated the rules.
You're in the same, I don't know if you call it denomination, it's Bishop Patterson, right? Gilbert Patterson, with the late.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was my dear friend.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what happened with that?
So they
didn't split the...
Oh, no. They just told me not to do it anymore. And I had to appear before a special committee, investigative committee, and was questioned and reprimanded.
Hmm.
And, of course, amazing thing that after that happened, after the inquisition and the reprimand, the chairman of the General Assembly, which is the lawmaking body of our church, said the Lord spoke to him and told him to establish a special committee to study the issue of women in ministry and the ordination. And he said the Lord told him to appoint McKinney to chair that committee.
God is good. All the time.
So for 2 years I served with that committee. If I have an excellent report, I'd like me to see it sometime.
Okay, I'd like to.
So we don't know what they're going to do, but it's going to happen.
Mm. That could have been really, really bad.
It could have been, because it was divisive.
But at least they stepped back.
The attitude about women.
Let's look at this.
Yeah. There were those who said, I would rather have an undelivered drug addict or a practicing homosexual, or I'd rather have anybody pastor me other than a woman.
Mm. When I go home, you see actually more women than men in the pulpit said, in the Baptist church there.
Yeah, it's happening.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Right. That's it.
How can you be true to your faith and indicate to a person who loves God, who has received the training and has demonstrated faithfulness?
Right.
How can you tell that person that God can't use you?
One of the questions was a challenge. I see that this is definitely one of your challenges.
It was a big challenge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I went through it, and I never stopped.
What made you stand firm on something you really believed in? Huh?
Yeah, I'm kind of crazy like that.
I don't call it crazy. Just stand firm on your beliefs.
When you believe something... There was inspiration from Martin Luther. You remember when he posted those statements on the little church in Wurttemberg. He said, "Here I stand, I can do no other. I think if you really believe God, if you believe, for some people, religion is just a game. It doesn't mean anything. God is dead, and they simply go along with certain religious things in order to benefit from the niceties.
Mm-hmm.
But if you believe that God is the creator and the father of all mankind, and he's sustainer of every good and perfect gift in the life itself, if you believe that spirituality is the most real, it is the greatest reality, if you believe that, then you come to some spiritual knowledge or understanding, you're bound to respect that, mm-hmm. to obey it. Even if you fail, you know that you failed and you repent of it.
Right.
But it's not a game.
No, it's not. Nope, it really is not.
So when I had a chance to do something about it, mm-hmm. then I couldn't say that. It couldn't be an innocent bystander.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What is, who would you say is your biggest influence, a role model?
In the ministry.
Mm-hmm. It could be in the ministry or just... and why?
My father had great influence on me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And because of his demonstrated love and devotion to God and his love for his family,
mm-hmm.
and he took time when he found out that I was going to enter the ministry, he took time with me to talk with me about the Bible,
mm-hmm.
about the church history and spiritual realities. He spent quality time with me, and I can never forget that.
That is important.
Then I had an old mentor in Toledo when I went. After graduating from seminary, went to Toledo, and we called him Dad Hawkins. He was about 90 years of age. He lived to be about 94, 95, and pastored up until his death.
Whoa.
And I used to just go by his house to sit, mm-hmm. in the same room with him. He didn't have to say anything, just wanted to be with him and soak up that atmosphere.
Right, yeah. I've been there. I know how.
You know, he was a wonderful man. But when he would open his mouth, that would be wisdom. So Dad Hawkins and my dad,
good.
And of course, my wife Jean and my wife Barbara, they are tremendous influences. I'm extremely fortunate to have Barbara at my... at this stage in my life, injecting new,
mm-hmm.
new life,
right.
new interests, new
just take you to a
new
different level, huh?
That's right.
That's wonderful. That's really
right.
Great. I appreciate you sharing that.
Did I mention to you that I told you about why I went back to get the PhD? Because
mm-hmm.
I felt I wanted to refresh,
right,
and to come back, and it really helped
you
me.
You never stop learning.
Yeah, it really helped me.
Mm-hmm.
Five sons, and I'm one of the few pastors that can praise God for all five sons and their wives and their children being believers. And all five sons are
that
ordained
is remarkable
ministers.
And
three
wonderful.
Three of them in seminary now.
Mm.
This is an article in Father's Day article about me.
Oh, okay.
Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen this one. Oh, this is wonderful. This is great.
In 2008, I was a candidate for general board, and of the 23 candidates, I came in number 4.
Wow.
I need
That's
to go
great.
Out here again.
Okay.
Okay.
So is there anything else you would like to, or anyone you would like to acknowledge who's been an influence or paved the way for you when you got here?
Yes, there have been many, some unsung heroes, and others have had some notoriety, but there are persons who were unselfish and committed to make San Diego and the nation a better place. And I think that I, along with everybody else here, who enjoy the beauty of San Diego and some definite improvement in race relations here, we owe a debt to people like Percy Steele and the pastors that I've mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But special note should be made of our debt to George Walker Smith, okay, who served as one of the early black elected officials and served on the Board of Education as chairman of the local Board of Education, and was instrumental in helping to steer the board in a direction toward equity
mm-hmm.
in education.
Okay.
We're indebted to people like George Stevens, who served as a city councilman, and after having been involved as a radical protester in the 60s. But
so I saw a picture of him walking with Dr. King.
Yeah. He was a part of that. Carol Wayman, with his work with the Citizens Interracial Committee. Howard Carey, who led the Neighborhood House for many years and was trained in social work at the University, Atlanta University. Johnny Johnson, John Johnson, who had a tremendous influence on the social, political, and educational life of this community as an organizer and as an able administrator. The list goes on and on, but there are some women that ought to be noted as well. There was a black woman who headed the Neighborhood House when, in the early 60s, when it was subjected to a strike and protest from the Hispanic community, and there was some real tension, but we worked through that. I think that Leon Williams has to be acknowledged because of his pioneering work, both on the city council and the sheriff's department, and of course with the supervisors, board of supervisors. The black physicians have been a noteworthy group, and the black lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
We remember Alpha Montgomery and Judge Gilliam,
right,
and others. These were my friends, and I can't name them all, but they were my friends, and they were instrumental in shaping San Diego, making it a better place.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's great. I'm going to ask, if you could go back, you can leave one of these people, but I don't want to change anything, but if you could go back, is there anything you regret doing or wish you had done better?
Mm-hmm.
You do? You want to share it?
Yeah, I don't mind.
Okay.
I don't mind. If I had to do it over again, I would be more careful to spend more quality time with my family.
Mm-hmm.
They were very patient and understanding with me because my schedule has been, as you could probably see,
right,
starting up all of these institutions and church, working at the church, and it meant that my wife and children sacrificed a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I would try to live a more balanced life.
Okay.
I would have taken the time to try to learn to play golf.
Wow, it's never too late.
Yes. Also, I would have.
I like that.
I would have sought out. I would, if I have a chance to do it, I would have sought out early a good financial counselor.
Mm-hmm.
who would have mentored me in making proper investments.
Mm-hmm.
I made some bad investments, but I didn't have the kind of counsel
right
that I needed.
Because that was something that wasn't on our radar.
No.
And it's just actually getting there now. People are seeing, I can own and I can do and I can be, but it wasn't something our parents ever talked to us about.
Or we knew anything about the stock market.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
And I would want to correct it. At this point in my life, I should have considerable wealth, mm-hmm. but we've given it all away,
mm-hmm.
and much of it has been devoted to social, economic, educational programs. I don't regret investing millions of dollars in education for the children of our community. I don't regret that. I don't regret investing millions of dollars for housing and services to the seniors. I could have done all of these things and still had some investments for my own children and my future.
Yep, that is very true. That's for all of us. What would you say is the biggest change that you've witnessed in San Diego since you've been here?
Mm-hmm.
And this has been
50 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the area of race relations, the opportunities for for service, for involvement, are much greater now than 50 years ago. 50 years ago, the opportunities for employment were very limited.
Mm-hmm.
Service jobs.
Right.
But now it's not uncommon to have presidents and vice presidents of banks and principals of schools,
mm-hmm. That's right.
and all of that. So
superintendent,
that's right.
And now we're everywhere as far as housing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that's the difference I've seen.
That's a big difference. And another thing I think is that when there are those who want to maintain the status quo or revert to the old behavior of racist, segregationist wickedness,
mm-hmm.
we have a greater opportunity now to go before the law and get justice than we had at one time. See, when I remember that when you just didn't have access to justice,
mm-hmm.
because the deck was stacked.
Yeah.
I've had some cases early on that were just downright blood-curdling, mm-hmm. but you couldn't do anything about it.
Right.
I remember one case where a young man was arrested, black boy, was arrested and charged with murder. But it was true that he had been a delinquent kid, but he didn't commit that murder. He was in mm-hmm. church that he had gotten saved. And he was in church that Sunday.
Mm.
And two of the ministers went to court with me to testify that the young man is saved now and he was in church,
mm-hmm.
and he did not commit this murder. And the judge said that, well, these Negroes, these blacks, they'll tell a lie for one another. And so they convicted that boy and sent him to prison.
Mm.
About a year and a half, 2 years later, the actual murderer came mm-hmm. forward and confessed. But here, this young man that we were working with.
Right.
And to say that black folk will lie, well, anybody will lie.
Right.
But sometimes some people tell the truth.
That's exactly right. Wow. So if that person hadn't come forward, he he would have been in prison longer for something.
Yeah,
he
probably for his life. Yeah.
There's no such thing as DNA then, and no. Well, that is so. But yeah, that was.
And the district attorneys, when the boy came home, we said, let's have a reception for him and welcome him home. And so I called the district attorneys and probation department, parole, and invited them all to come because we were going to do it at the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the word from the district attorney's office. He said, well, I'm not coming to no celebration for him. Say, he's the kind of guy who was capable of committing a murder.
Just wasn't going to sway. You know, really put it in his mind. He was going to be negative toward. That's really sad. Bishop McKinney, thank you so much. I do want to ask two more questions.
Okay.
One is, what do you think are some of the major issues still facing minorities in San Diego today?
The major issues facing minorities in San Diego today are for the youth. It's hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And that hopelessness has to do, I think, with a number of the realities. Some of it has to do with the kind of attitude that prevails regarding the meaning of life, mm-hmm. so that the life is cheap. And it affects one's behavior when there is the feeling that life has no meaning, it's worthless. There's also a problem, I think, with the changes that have taken place in the economy and the social structure that's very unsettling. The young people ask the question, and I am too. What's going on?
Right. Yes.
And until there's some clarity about what's going on.
It's almost scary.
Yes.
So fluid.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's that. The other thing, I think, economically, we're in a very desperate time. This is many young people, sons and daughters of middle-class blacks, will not have the quality of life their parents had.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's frustrating. We wanted to do better than our parents.
Right.
But
why won't they have it? Because of the economy and the recession
and their own loss of creativity.
Yeah.
Because you can make it if you want to.
There
are still people who want it. You can make it. So at the bottom of it all is a spiritual problem, and that is, there is, as the philosopher said, there's a God-shaped vacuum in every man's heart, and only God can fill it. Until God is acknowledged and truth is embraced, we will continue to be empty, destructive, and violent.
That's a good message, not only to youth, but everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good.
We try to make it without God, and it ain't, it's not working now, never has.
Yeah. So I thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think my wife might have some wisdom.
Would you like First Lady Barbara? I would appreciate it.
Would you do that, include Sister Barbara?
She's, absolutely.
She's,
yes, sir.
Now, she's a genius. Come right over
here. I always welcome the voice.
Well,
having listened to Bishop McKinney, your husband, give his life story. Mm-hmm. What is your overall view of San Diego and the place that he holds now and will forever hold, in my opinion, as, you know, a beacon light in this community? And also, was there anything that surprised you or that you heard that you didn't know? And there's something that just makes you really proud, you know, like these the mothers and daughters of children when you see them graduate. You was like, you were so proud you could just pop.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. I think I've heard many of the stories before, and in talking about being proud of someone, I listened to his history and the kind of things he's had to go through, and to come out with this position of forgiveness, his feelings of love to everybody, regardless of what has happened with him down through the years, the sensitivity that he has when it comes to all people. I am, yeah, sometimes I'm just in awe when I listen to him on a Sunday morning, because he's such a tremendous man of God. And you hear about men of God, and you know that they're supposed to be a certain way and their lifestyle, but he is such a true man of God, because he's that way in the pulpit, and he's that way also at home. And
so he's walking the walk and talk.
Yes, yes. And I am very proud of him, and I am just so happy that I am a part of his life, and we're walking the rest of this journey together, and it's been very exciting. It's been probably the best part of my life, just to know someone like him, just to know him, and then to know that he is my partner in life.
Right.
is awesome. And it's kind of an awesome responsibility, because I want to be the best that I can be because of him, so that we together can accomplish some of the things that he's planning to do. He is still out there, as he's shared with you, doing all kinds of things, and I am excited about it. And I just want to be what he needs at this time in his life to help him reach those ultimate goals.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
by the way, that's very kind of you to say all those nice things.
Yeah.
And okay. Barbara McKinney.
Yes. Barbara Jo McKinney.
Thank you both again. I really appreciate it. And our community will have an opportunity to hear how you have been just an inspiration to a lot of people, and the many wonderful things, Bishop McKinney, you have been a part of in this great community. And I thank you.
Thank you.
I thank you for your lifelong efforts to
do
better.
You got some things you left out.
I did tell her some of the bad stories.
Okay.